So October 2nd, if nobody's welcomed to October yet, welcome to October. Where's the time go? Lecture 12, lecture notes page 97. If you are interested in working for a living someday into the future, you might be interested in hooking up, making connections to, networking with businesses. So tomorrow is the Sales and Marketing Career Fair from 1 to 3 p.m. in room 218. Of the Kent State University Student Center. Technically, I think they probably want you to register, but you know what? If you drop by, you can meet some interesting people. Often our alumni are the people staffing the tables, sometimes fun from different companies. So drop by, say hi, network out a bit. Also, if you're interested in sales, if not as a career, a major or minor, maybe you just want to find out more about it, join the club. So the KSU Sales Club, I think, is a brand new club getting going, meets every other Thursday at 5:30 p.m. with the next meeting October 12th in the Brinzo Lab of the College of Business on the first floor. If you're interested or intrigued, check with Sydney at that email, and Sydney will be happy to chat with you about the KSU Sales Club. Calendar-wise, here's those that prefer the more visual calendar. And as you can see, we are here on the 2nd, and my big exciting part was the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday stuff. Fall break. Some people weren't paying attention. They don't know what's coming. So fall break is coming. We will open our mini test 6 on its standard time, which will be tomorrow. But out of respect for spring break, we'll keep it open until some later date that isn't up there, but I'm sure with you in a minute. then, of course, you know that midterm 1 closes 6 p.m. on Wednesday. So here we go. Mini test 6 will open tomorrow on the 3rd. We'll keep it open until the 10th after spring break. What else can I tell you? I can tell you that mini test 5 closed on Sunday. You can't see it there because I hit it with the arrow, but the average score was 90%. Midterm 1 is up and running. How many people have taken it? I know. Oh, really? That many? Well, good for you. And some of you are happy with your score. Others are not, but there's that. Questions on the midterm, by the way. So far, nobody's had any proctorio questions that they've emailed me about. Yay, you. Enhanced earning extra credit in number 3 closed last week, I guess, in 0.22 points, but it's adding up over time. So you've added 0.75 to your total class grade. Eventually, that could grow towards 3%. The next one will open Thursday and stay open until after spring break or after fall break on Wednesday. We know about the midterm exam. This has been up quite a bit, 50 questions, 80 minutes for standard time, closes at 6 p.m. on Wednesday. Somebody's going to come back and say, I didn't know it was open and closed at 6. I thought it closed at midnight. No. Webbies, 6 p.m. Open book, open notes. Please have your physical book, your physical notes with you. Freshly reboot your computer, which avoids problems with Proctorio. We've been over this before. I don't know what else to say. Any questions on the midterm? I'm asking again. All right, perfect. I'll post midterm grades after we get our curve in our midterm one up. Business in the news, Ford tried to sell the electric Mustang to China, the Tesla way. It didn't work. What's your image? Who still knows? I know how old I am. How old are you? Who still knows Mustang, has an image of Mustang? Anybody? Oh, everybody. So what's your image of Mustang in your mind? What comes to mind? Classic car? Who has any other description for it? Yeah. Cool muscle car, okay? So now we're shifting from the cool muscle car days of the, you know, the gasoline engine. We're shifting to electronic, and we're going to make a big splash, we'll see, in China. Well, you can see the answer. It didn't work. After years of sales troubles in China, Ford Motor Vehicle saw a chance to ride the tide of electrification to arrest its demise. So we're seeing their growth strategy. We're seeing international marketing. Our next chapter, by the way, coming up shortly, is global marketing. Beginning in 2020, Ford followed Tesla's formula of bypassing dealers to sell its car directly to consumers, so not using dealerships. It introduced the Mustang Mach-E, an electric SUV with the iconic Galloping Horse logo, which Ford executives saw as a strong competitor to Tesla's electric vehicles. So we're seeing a bit of innovation in distribution going around dealers, and of course competition in that foreign marketplace. Today, Ford remains and also ran in the world's biggest auto market. In August, Ford pulled the plug on its direct sales business. The Mach-E has not fared well, with sales at a few hundred a month this year, far behind the tens of thousands of vehicles sold each month by Tesla and many Chinese rivals. You can see that that's not good. Ford's market share in China was 2% last year, with sales down 61% from 2016 on a wholesale basis. So they got to do something to adjust strategy against competition, because this certainly isn't working. Reasons for the failure include flawed marketing and sales strategies, such as not giving the Mach-E a Chinese name. Turns out that the name Mustang, they lost permission to use it in China because of some sort of copyright issue. Mustang was sounded like something else and was used by some other company, and they didn't jump on the opportunity to replate it with a Chinese name. Not good strategy. Also, underestimating how crowded the EV market would become, the car itself is not attractive as among similarly priced cars. Mach-E's driving range is shorter. Ooh, there's an advantage. Basic versions of the Tesla's Model Y and XPeng's P7. And it has fewer cameras and radars for driving assistant features than NIO's ES6. So we have lack of a Chinese name, it hindered brand recognition, it lacks any standout features. Wow, let's take that to market. Ford's Mach-E struggles to serve as a cautionary tale for foreign companies in China. Nimble Chinese brands. Remember we talked about marketing agility in the first couple days, navigating the whitewater rapids of business? Chinese companies are nimble, offering attractive products quickly, often with cutting-edge technology, while foreign name brands, even iconic ones like Mustang, no longer guarantee an automatic status in the market. So succeeding against local competition in a foreign market can be hard. Moving forward, Ford has abandoned selling directly to consumers, part of adjusting to the field strategy so far. Recent going back to selling through dealerships in a joint venture with Chinese state-owned car maker Chongqing Chang'an Automobile. Ford and Chang'an plan to launch new electric vehicles in 2024 in China. We'll have to see what happens. So direct sales are really expensive if the volume is low, which is what they had. We'll have to stay tuned and see if their adjustments work out or not. So even a pretty successful company like Ford can struggle in a foreign market. If you came in, you heard today we were doing a little Swifty stuff, related stuff. Jake from State Farm watched Jason Kelce's Eagles game with Donna Kelce in a spoof of the Kelce Swift hype. Does anybody not know what the Kelce Swift hype is? Because the story's not as funny if you don't know what I'm talking about. Everybody knows what's going on there. Great. Okay. So it turns out Travis Kelce's brother Jason has a celebrity admirer as well. So Travis's admirer is Taylor Swift. Here we have somebody else going on, Jake from State Farm. So we're using celebrities in advertising. In an amusing twist on all the Taylor Swift hype around Travis, State Farm and agency Maxim Effort orchestrated a stunt on Sunday that saw Jake sitting with Donna Kelce to watch her other son's team, the Philadelphia Eagles, play the Washington Commanders. Jake and Donna seem to be fast corporate approved friends hanging out together for the duration of the game. They were on Instagram. And they picked a good one as the Eagles outlasted the Commanders 34-31 in overtime. So marketing and pop culture opportunities playing out. Jake is well known for urging consumers to bundle their auto and home insurance. In an email to Ad Age, State Farm on Sunday said that the Jake and Donna were bundles we didn't know we needed. Jake and Jason also spent some time together. They were spotted leaving the players' tunnel together after the game. Obviously not a major push, but they're playing off, boom, agilely on something that's happening in pop culture. So yay, good for them. Legos fans? Legos, yeah. So Lego's latest Bind Your Flow campaign aims to help adults to de-stress, which we could probably all use. Lego is not just a toy company that attracts construction-minded children. It's a brand that crosses generations. And to acknowledge that broad fan base and remind them that play is worthwhile at any age, the brand has produced a campaign focusing on improving mental health through sound. So we're positioning the brand We're doing some socially responsible marketing. With the aim of reaching adult builders, Lego has released a film based on the sound of its bricks. The narrative focuses on a bad day at work for its female protagonist until she's able to close the door of her apartment behind her and focus on spending time with her cat and her building her new Lego set. So this is the ad theme. I do not know why this is so dark. I don't know if it's my copy or the way they did it. I'm going to get this running and then I'm going to kill the lights, so perhaps we have a better chance of seeing it. Let's see if this works. Just a little bit of de-stressing, just playing music in the background with not too much going on. De-stress with your cat and your Legos. So she got to close the door of her apartment behind her, focus on spending time with her cat and her new Lego set, the ad theme. Our intention for the campaign was to encourage more adults to take a moment to find their flow through building with Lego bricks or engaging in other similar hands-on, minds-on type of activities, says Genevieve Capa Cruz, head of product for adults at the Lego Group. So target audience, campaign theme. For over 90 years at the Lego Group, we've had a singular purpose to inspire and develop the builders of tomorrow through play. When a child plays, they develop key life skills like creativity, confidence, and resilience. However, we have thousands of fans of all ages who inspire us every day with their Lego creations, said Capa Cruz. While kids will always be our focus, we know Lego building appeals to people of all ages. We have a very strong, passionate adult community whose support, endless creativity, and engagement has helped us make Lego the brand of what it is today. So engaging with the consumer, we'll hear later on in lecture how they do that, not today, but a future one, and keeping it up through this campaign. So on the lecture notes, page 97, chapter 6, page 173 in the textbook. So we had just ended up with an example of Hershey's doing some B2B buying, and we ran out of time as we were about to talk about online buying in organizational markets. I digress a bit. This is not testable. How many of you guys are following what's going on with Amazon and the government's potential suit of them for monopoly purposes? Anybody following that? So it's gonna be, how many guys do shop regularly on Amazon? I may have asked that question. So do you like it? Do you think it's a good deal? Yeah, so the question is, are they actually messing with the consumer? Because if I'm a vendor on Amazon and I advertise somewhere else less expensively, they essentially block my sale from Amazon. They delist me. Are they really saving us as much money as they should? Are they coercive in terms of what they're getting their suppliers to do? Be interested to see what happens in that consumer world online. Anyhow, obviously, as you would guess, online buying in organizational markets is prevalent, as it is with you as consumers. We have a lot of e-marketplaces for businesses in the B2B world, just as we would have in the B2C world. But in business, we will run into a lot more online auctions in organizational markets. Who's engaged in an online auction to buy something in the B2C world? What have you used? What platform? eBay. How many people have bought something on eBay? Yeah, lots of folks. So you're familiar certainly with how that plays out. So in a traditional auction, a seller puts up an item for sale. You're familiar with that. various buyers out there bid in competition with one another for that product. So what happens as you get more and more bidders? What happens to the price that you're going to pay for it? More and more bidders bid that price up, right? So it puts an upward pressure on price. Then the auction ends when there's a single bidder, although on eBay I think you can just kick and click and buy now, right? You can cheat the system. But usually that buy now price is pretty high compared to where the auction point is. So we see this in the B2B world, in a traditional auction, visual learners, it looks like that. One seller is out there offering a product. And as you can see, the little chart says, as you get more and more buyers, that price goes up and up and up, till finally one buyer gets the deal, right? However, we also see on in the B2B world a reverse auction. In this case, we have a buyer that goes out to the marketplace and says, hey, I need bids on this product or service. I need you to provide this product or service to me. Then various suppliers go out and they bid in competition to provide that service or that product. Now here you have the opposite effect. The greater number of suppliers out there bidding to offer the product or service, what happens now to the price? People are bidding down to get that product or that service. Then the auction ends when a single bidder or supplier is left, who of course has to meet the standards and specs of the person that's buying the product or the service. So I don't know if we see that much reverse auction in the world of B2C, although a while ago, in the days, I think, before we had the home sale bubble burst a bunch of years ago, there was an ad that had a couple in their kitchen. Guy in a business suit was sitting there talking to them, and then there were a bunch of guys lined up in the hallway getting ready to talk to them. These guys were bankers, and they were bidding on offering them the best deal for their home, for their bank loan. So that was a reverse auction in the B2C world. So, visual learners, there you go, the reverse auction. Lots of sellers out there. Price drops down the more sellers you have till there's one seller left for the buyer. And this used to connect to, yeah, there's actually information out there. There's a government site on reverse auctioning if that's something you'd like to learn more about. All right, so that's the end of our B2B chapter, thinking about organizations as customers. We certainly have touched quite a bit in business/marketing the news on global marketing, and obviously it's a big topic in the world today, given our various government stances on such things. So here we have understanding and reaching global consumers and markets. We're into chapter 7. Lecture out pages 101. So why is it such a big deal? Well, why do we engage in international trade? Why bother? Well, we do it to get access to materials or products or services that are not available domestically, or that are available but at a higher price or lower quality or less technology. For many semesters, I've been able to say this with pretty much authority. Now, of course, we know, given what's happened with the pandemic and supply chain issues and all of the problems that that's brought about, it's not 100% clear whether or not we're in love with international trade that offers us lower costs. Maybe we're better off bringing some stuff home, even though the cost might be higher, to guarantee supply. So I'm telling you what's been the traditional wisdom before the pandemic and the supply chain failure. Also, to get access to markets that want our materials, our products, our services, assuming there's not a current embargo going on with whatever country we're trying to get into, because of comparative advantage. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. Some countries have unique national or human resources that give them a competitive edge internationally, and so we want to deal with those folks that have the best competition situation out there. Market saturation at home. How many more Starbucks do we need in the U.S.? Where's the closest Starbucks to us? Right there on the corner. Where's the next closest one? And then the next closest one. There you go. I mean, within a quarter mile, we've got three Starbucks in Kent, Ohio. there was a parody going on for a while. I didn't see it, but I read about it, where they had a parody of a Starbucks having a Starbucks in their bathroom. So it was a Starbucks inside of Starbucks was the joke. How many more Starbucks are you going to have in the U.S.? Let's think about growing internationally because we're saturated at home. Potential demand. People out there just really want whatever it is we're offering, whatever we're selling. It's not market saturation. It's just a call for the product. And customer expectations in the B2B world. They're going to go internationally. They want you as a supplier to go internationally with them. All reasons to engage in international trade. I foreshadowed the pandemic problem. The pandemic led to a surge in online spending and the biggest shopping revolution in the West since malls and supermarkets. But it is in China, not the West, where the future of e-commerce is being staked out. The China market is bigger, more creative, and tech firms there are blending e-commerce, social media, and more to become the online shopping business for 850 million digital consumers. What's the entire population of the U.S.? 330 million. They have 850 million digital shoppers. Seems like there might be a market opportunity there. The China e-commerce market overtook the U.S. as in 2013. And today is worth more than $2 trillion, more than the U.S. and e-commerce, Europe combined. The China e-commerce market is dynamic, highly competitive, as we just saw a little bit ago with our Ford example, to innovation, such as demolishing the boundaries between different types of services that are still common in the West. They blend together digital payments, group deals, social media, gaming, instant messaging, short-form videos, and live streaming celebrities onto single platforms. In the West, Visa specialized in payments, Amazon in e-commerce, Facebook and social media, Google and search, and so on. The West is largely underestimating China and finding it difficult to compete there when they get there. Multinational firms like Unilever, L'Oreal, Adidas make more revenue in Asia than in America. And they look to there, not to California or Paris, to see the latest in digital marketing, branding, and logistics. To be competitive, some Western companies are diversifying. Facebook promotes shopping services on its social networks and engages in social commerce, including live streaming and the use of WhatsApp for messaging between merchants and shoppers. Walmart hosted its first live shopping event using TikTok, a Chinese-owned app. From electronics to solar panels, Chinese manufacturing advances have been ignored or dismissed as copying by the West, then downplayed and then grudgingly acknowledged around the world as being really good. Today, it's the Chinese consumers' tastes and habits that are going global. Let's see what that means for our future. What does all this mean to the U.S.? Well, one issue, as you recall from your economics class, right, is the idea of balance of trade, the difference between the monetary value of a nation's exports and imports. Before I reveal it, does the U.S. have greater exports or greater imports? Greater imports by a fair amount. So here we see what's going on. If you can see the exports, by the way, what's the chart tell me about exports over time if we do a trend line? What are they doing over time? They are increasing. It's not like we're declining in our exports, but what's the problem? That imports are increasing even more. So exports are up. Yeah, sure, you know, we got the pandemic in there, but that's not the trend line. Imports, though, are up even more. So what does this mean to our, quote, balance of trade? Our balance of trade is negative. We send a lot more money out to other countries than we bring in from those countries. You can feel any way you want to about that. If you're a politician, an economist, you may have particular feelings about that. On the other hand, it looks like if you're a business person, there could be a lot of opportunity importing and a lot of opportunity exporting. So as an individual company, you might look at import-export because there's a lot of activity going on there. This button should take us to today's, let's see if it does, to today's situation as of last month, perhaps. Let's see if that's up and accurate. So January, February is 2022. So July, this is probably the last date they had. And what do we see? Exports, 164 55, imports 256. So here we are, negative in the month of July, and for the year, as you would expect it to be, ongoing. The situation has not changed. What's it mean to Ohio, where most of us are from? Ohio is the 9th largest exporting and the 11th largest importing state in the nation. Bet you didn't know that. Within a one-day drive of most major U.S. metros, the Cincinnati region's location means products arrive at the customer's door faster. Our strong logistics industry moves large and small items via air, river, rail, or road. So if you're looking to do business in America, why not come to Ohio? And here is Ohio's website, focusing other folk who are looking to come here, build with us. Foreign direct investment pays off in Ohio. So Ohio's interested in having you meet people, whether you're international, whether you're from Canada, China, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, we have somebody for you to talk to. So there are 4,300 international establishments originating from more than 50 countries in Ohio. And here we are at foreign direct investment in the Cincinnati area, if you're interested, as somebody coming in from a foreign country with a bunch of stats. So Ohio believes in international trade. They're willing to talk to other companies from other countries about doing business here. Here we're talking a little bit about what I mentioned at the start about why doing international trade is the idea of competitive advantage. This is Michael Porter, a well-known Harvard guru on business and marketing. And Porter talks about this in terms of Porter's diamond. The question being, why do some industries and some firms become world leaders and others lose out or fail? And in part, the answer is due to competitive advantages of those nations. And you can see he has a little diamond here with four different factors, and you can see they all interact with each other in various ways. Let's take a look at these factors individually and think about what they mean for business as a competitive advantage of nations. Factor conditions. These are things like natural resources, yeah? So if you want to source diamonds, where are you likely to go? What part of the world? Africa, right? Ohio is not a good source for diamonds. It's not going to work very well. Of course, we have the whole issue of blood diamonds. We want our source to be clean. We don't want to be harming people, etc. But they have a natural advantage in going when it comes to that natural resource. And other parts of the world have other advantages. Education and skill levels of that population are an important factor. If you're either trying to do business there, hire workers there, or turn it around, sell products there. Different countries have different advantages there. The wage rates, of course, that's why we chased our manufacturing first to Mexico and then to China and then to Thailand and then to Vietnam, looking for lower wage rates. Kuwait specializes in, as do other countries, the production of oil for an obvious reason. They got a lot of oil. And so that's an advantage. They have Hollywood. Is the film production star because it has a concentration of skilled labor in the area when they're not on strike, and excellent film schools. So what's the other really big place in the world where you might go to make a film? Anybody know what I'm referring to?
Bollywood
is the other place you can go. So let's be fair, there are a couple other places, but you're probably not going to Canada if you're really setting up your film industry, right? Japan has a relative lack of raw materials. Why is that true? Why does Japan have a relative lack of raw materials? They're an island country. They don't have vast resources there, which has driven a lot of things that eventually actually impact us. For example, that's forced them to focus on miniaturization, which they've done very well. Just-in-time inventory delivery, zero defect manufacturing. They don't have a lot of stuff to waste. It drives your industry, but also drives our industry, too, as we try to compete with them. So if you're a marketer, business, the question is, given these factor conditions, can you produce in this country? And obviously there's a little touch of can you sell in this country as well, given their wage and education and skill levels. Second element that Porter talks about in terms of competitive advantages of nations is demand conditions in those countries. How big is that market? China, pretty big market, yeah? How sophisticated are the consumers? We already used, I think we used the example. Did we use the example about, I forget what we used and we haven't used. Hold on, I gotta think about this a second. I'll probably, if I haven't used it before, I'll probably use it twice again, but let me use the example. What does illiterate mean? Illiterate? Can't read. Does it mean you're stupid? It just means you can't read. In some parts of the world, the population is illiterate, not stupid. They just can't read. Let's take an example then of selling products in a store where people are illiterate. How do they know what they're buying? Pictures, yeah? All right, so a true story told to me is that Gerber decides to sell Gerber baby food products in jars the way they do in Africa, where there's a lot of illiterate people. What does Gerber have on their labels for most of their baby food product? Babies. What did people read was inside the jars? Ground up babies. Not the intent in this particular situation. But you can see where you do have to consider the level of sophistication of your consumers as you consider whether or not you can sell in this product. The problem, of course, is not with the consumer. The problem is with the marketer who's not paying attention to the sophistication level. This is a simple example, but walk it through your company's advanced technology or whatever it might be. Media exposure of products. Can you reach people in this country as a B2B or as a B2C with the information about your product? German consumers have demanded a high level of engineering in their cars, the ones that they buy at home. So this means that Mercedes and BMW and Porsche have done well in Germany. It's allowed them to dominate the world in high-performance cars. That's what their people want. They don't do well in the cheap, mass-produced car market in general, because that's not what their consumers are looking for. So is there a demand for our product given these demand conditions? Market size, sophistication, media exposure for your product out there, a second characteristic. A third one is the question of related and supporting industries. Do you have an appropriate cluster of suppliers that you would need to do business in this country? If not, how are you building whatever it is you're making? We have national strengths associated with clusters of industries. For example, in the US, Silicon Valley has an advantage in that particular technology. Ohio has a significant supplier cluster in aerospace and defense, along with advanced manufacturing, healthcare, logistics, and food processing. And so given what you need to manufacture in this part of the world, can you get the support you need given their natural advantage, given what they have? And hello. All right, so this is me showing clusters just for fun in the US. So cars, Detroit, financial services, New York, educational services, Massachusetts, federal government, Washington, DC, crude petroleum and natural gas in Houston, Las Vegas, casino and hotels, LA, we talked about motion picture production, San Francisco technology, Washington, Seattle, manufacturing. Interesting. So if you were coming into the US, would we have clusters that would support whatever it is you're doing? In Germany, there are strong supplier clusters in automotive manufacturing, which we've alluded to a minute ago. Italy has developed strong supplier clusters in fashion up in Tuscany, furniture over in Lombardy, and machinery. I don't know what that means. Emilia Romagna. All right. South Korea has built robust supply clusters in consumer electronics and in shipbuilding. So, the question is, do you have the supply cluster that you need? Within this, we also talk about a company's strategy, structure, and rivalry. As you go to market in this country, how many other companies are already there? We just heard from Ford. Ford grossly underestimated the amount of competition they would have in the EV market to their detriment. Somebody wake up and do some research. How many countries, companies are already there that you're going to have to compete with? How intense is that competition? Are they weak, whatever you're going against in this country? Or are they strong? There's a lot of intense competition. Are they owned publicly or privately? Again, has to do with how well you're going to do with funding, etc. Are they government funded? Are they subsidized? Competition can actually drive innovation and drive upgrades in products. For example, Japan in the day, small island country, had 9 major car competitors plus foreign markets. That drove early on competition. What car company, if you don't know, do you imagine had the first cup holders? Somebody say? Toyota. Everybody has them now, but why did they, where were they innovative? They were driven to be better than everybody else by intense competition. So can you be competitive in this country, given all the things we've just chatted about? So some research you have to do to think about these things before you just willy-nilly decide to enter a country and try to do well. So firms that succeed in global markets have succeeded first in intense domestic competition through continuous improvement. They know how to rapidly fix products in a foreign market, through innovation, bringing in new ideas and concepts, and through managing change. All things we should talk to Ford about, I think, as they think about the Mustang in China. I see pens moving and fingers typing. Let me have a little sip of vodka here, water here. Can you believe I got busted 1 year? I'm joking about drinking vodka. Somebody writes and says, that's not funny. People have drinking problems. Why are you kidding about vodka? It's water. It's water. You can't please everybody, I will tell you that. All right. So let's think about marketing in today's economic world and see the trends that are out there. We have issues of economic protectionism that impact us in business. The prior U.S. administration, do I have to say who that is, or we all know who that was? I'm going to assume you know who it was. Favored economic protectionism. The current administration, I hope you know who that is, is more in favor of more open trade. The question is, should Congress use political situations as a reason for more protectionism? Keeping other people out of our country, keeping within our own country for our sales, not exporting, not importing, is an open question. Some politicians argue that the benefit of today's relatively free trade system go unfairly and go primarily to low-wage countries which take jobs away from Americans. How many people have heard that somewhere, that concept? Okay. Factually, it's not clear that that's actually the case. America's economy over the past few decades has proved that openness coupled with flexibility makes the economic pie much bigger, and the benefits can be widely shared. Other countries benefit, so do we. It's not either or. It's not a single pie. President Ronald Reagan, who you may remember was a Republican, said a creative, competitive America is the answer to a changing world, not trade wars that would close doors, create greater barriers, and destroy millions of jobs. We should always remember protectionism is destructionism. Sure, there can be negotiated trade issues, etc. It doesn't mean it's entirely an open market. But if you're operating in a world just inside yourself, it's not going to work well for you. The China-United States trade is an ongoing economic conflict between China and the U.S. In 2018, President Donald Trump began setting tariffs and other trade barriers on China with the goal of forcing it to make changes to what the U.S. says are unfair trade practices. If you set trade restrictions on another country, in general, what do you suppose the reaction is going to be? Say again? get it. I'm an old guy. So you're saying what their reaction would be?
Supply line shortage.
On the one hand, you'd have supply line shortage because you're setting trade restrictions. What else would their response be? If you punch me in my face, what am I likely to do? Thank you. Punch you back. If I set trade restrictions on your country, what are you likely to do? Set trade restrictions on me. And of course, don't punch me in my face to make the point, but the point is that is indeed the sort of things that happen. I set trade restrictions on you, you set trade restrictions on me. Yay, who wins on that? So, among those trade practices and their effects are the growing trade deficit, the theft of intellectual property, and the forced... So, I'm not saying that there's never any problems. What his point was is that we do have a trade deficit with many countries of the world, including China. True, there is theft of intellectual property in China. They don't govern or legislate against that very well. True, there is a forced transfer of American technology to China. So I'm not saying that his complaints were wrong. They are. But in dealing with it, with trade barriers, they come back at us. The trade war negatively impacted the economies of both the US and China. In the United States, it led to higher prices for consumers, financial difficulties for farmers and manufacturers who, of course, were embargoed, were trade blocked by China. In China, economic growth and growth of manufacturing activity slowed to the lowest rates in decades. Yay, who's winning this with this, these trade things? In other countries, it has also caused economic damage, though some countries benefited from increased manufacturing to fill the gaps. So if you aren't dealing with China, then you're dealing with Thailand or Vietnam, all fine and good, but it's not really a big win. China has been GM's largest retail sales market since 2012. Let's ignore Ford for the moment. A favorable relationship between the US and China is important for maintaining its business relationships with the country. The pandemic, a weakening Chinese economy, and trade wars with the US have impacted their sales. So a big market for GM being impacted by these political decisions. So here's GM sales in China and the US across the years. We can see that in 2019 under the prior administration with all these things going on, they dropped again in 2021. Now admittedly, some of that's the pandemic. 2022, they jumped back up a bit. So they're concerned about these relationships that we have between our country and China. So protectionism in the world, in world trade, comes in two flavors. One approach to protectionism involves tariffs. Anybody have at the top of their head what a tariff is? What's a tariff do? So tariffs are a government tax on goods or services that are coming into your country. They serve primarily to raise prices on imports. So I put a tariff in for products from your country, whatever they are, solar panels from your country coming to my country. Who then pays that tariff? Who pays the tariff? The consumer, or at least the person in the States buying the product. Some people think the tariff is paid by the foreign country. It is not. So when it comes in, either the supplier in domestic is going to eat some of that tariff, or you're going to pay for the tariff, all right? So it increases prices in the US, or in the country that we're talking about. Quotas are the other way that we engage in protectionism. Quotas are a restriction placed on the amount of a product allowed to enter or to leave a country. Of course, this limits the supply of that product in whichever way you're going, whichever way you consider about it. So these are two ways that we have to protect our economy from international trade. Now, what effect do either tariffs or quotas have on international trade? Do you suppose it increases trade? Right. So these things in the end are simply going to decrease world trade. Now you may have other reasons for doing it. There may be political reasons for doing it. The things that President Trump talked about with the China were problems, certainly. It's not clear whether or not this is the best way to address them because both parties, us and they lose. Your opinion may vary. We go back a little bit in time to think about the issues of protectionism. We have to go back all the way for this particular part of the conversation to after World War II, a long time ago. And the countries got together and they said, what can we do to avoid some of the economic issues that contributed to World War? And they said, what if we all get together economically and work together? So we have economic ties. We're not as likely just to throw them away, to go to war. This led to something called the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Technically, the GATT is still out there and active. It's been supplanted by something I'm going to talk about in a minute. But that was the initial approach. The GATT was a treaty, was not an organization. It ran 47 to 94 when it became superseded by another situation. Back then, it focused on merchandise trade, services, which are a huge part of our economy today, weren't a big deal then. So the GATT focused on trade. And one big problem was it had no mechanism for dealing with disputes to the treaty. So you weren't doing what you're supposed to do. Well, wait a minute. What are we going to do about that? How many of you guys know, though, the WTO? I assume most of us are right. So the WTO comes in, supersedes most of the GATT. Its main goal, it understands the problems with what I'm going to say, it's not naive, is a world that has trade without discrimination. Every country would trade fairly and equally with every other country. Hold your breath on that. It ain't happening anytime soon, but that's their goal. As a step back from a world without discrimination, it does recognize and accept and approve, if you will, of regional trade agreements, where at least everybody in the pact is trading fairly and openly with one another. What's one such trade agreement that comes to mind for us that you know about? Well, if only NAFTA were a thing anymore, yes. NAFTA, of course, has been replaced by the US-Canada-Mexico trade agreement, but the point is we trade among ourselves without tariffs, without blockage, without quotas going on. And they say, okay, look, we understand that's going to happen, so we'll support that where necessary. Their goal is also to have predictable and growing access to markets. If you're going to have a tariff, it's a binding tariff. You don't go messing around with it so that countries know how to deal with you. You're not jerking them around, which makes trade flow better. Promoting fair competition, just as we have some legitimate complaints about China, and in fact, their government holding up, supporting, providing support for certain programs over there, the U.S. is not without blame. The U.S. also does a little bit of unfair competition as we support farmers, or whoever it might be, with a little government support that makes them more competitive than they would otherwise be, so we're not blameless. Encouraging development and economic reform is another goal of the WTO. Over 3/4 of its members are developing countries who really could benefit from some economic development, economic reform, to make things work better, smoother, more fairly, and for them to be competitive. So, for many years, I took students over to Geneva, Switzerland, and here we are outside the World Trade Organization. There we are inside the World Trade Organization. the guy we're sitting with there, who you can sort of see, is wearing a pair of cheap KSU blue sunglasses. Have you seen those plastic sunglasses we have around the building? Yeah. So I took those over to Patrick Lowe, who's the chief economist for the World Trade Organization. He really likes socializing with our can I say co-eds, female students? What's the word phrase here that won't get me in trouble? Socializing with our students, and here he is with a bunch of students. He had just taken us out to an elaborate dinner, bought us a bunch of drinks. We bought him drinks first. And so we are out there celebrating at the World Trade Organization. He's retired since, I don't know, did I take his? Yeah, I had to think, well, never mind. So, the World Trade Organization, trying to work with a lot of countries of the world. How many countries are there in the world today? Ish. How many? Four? Two. About 200. We're going to claim 196. Okay? There are 196 countries in the world today, depending on how you count. I'll mention that in a minute. Of that, there are, quote, only 150 in the World Trade Organization. Can you imagine sitting 150 people together and trying to come to agreements, conclusions, set policies? It's a very tricky thing for them to do what they need to do. Now, there's 196 countries, unless you don't count Taiwan. Taiwan is not considered an official country by many, which would bring the count down to 195, and is, of course, a contention thing going right now with China and the U.S. Although Taiwan operates as an independent country, many countries, including the U.S., do not officially recognize it because the People's Republic of China considers Taiwan a breakaway province of China. Countries who wish to maintain diplomatic relations with China have had to sever their formal relations with Taiwan. More than 100 countries, however, have unofficial relations with Taiwan. Did you follow in the news recently? China got pretty unhappy because some U.S. government official visited Taiwan directly, and they were pretty unhappy about that. Maybe more than one, I forget. So, making political statements in the world. Let me see what this takes me to. Country issues. So, the issue here dealt with the idea of protectionism. Second sort of related thing to world trade is the rise of economic integration, the opposite of protectionism. So you know that the EU, right, consists of 27 countries with more than 440 million consumers as of Britain's exit in 2020. It used to be these were all separate countries with separate borders, separate rules, separate regulations. Getting your goods from one country to another, and Europe is not that big. Who's been to Europe? It's not that big. And so you're going from one country to the next, and you're having to stop to do bills of lading and restrictions and taxes. You had to show your, you're not old enough to remember that, passports as you went from country to country. How inefficient. They said, let's stop that. So they all got together, yeah? And they said, hey, let's offer up 440 million consumers without these problems. It operates as an internal single market that allows a free movement of goods, of capital, of services, and of people between those member states. So we have a bit of economic integration going on there. They always pick on us in the world for not being able to find anything on a map, students. So there we go. All that blue stuff, purple stuff, is part of the EU. Our friends over here in England and Northern Ireland are no longer part of the EU. What's this funky country right here that's right in the middle of everything and not part of the EU? Switzerland. Switzerland likes its independence, likes its neutrality, likes the way they play with their banking rules, and does not care to be tied into the EU. They're doing okay for themselves. You were in Geneva. Bern, okay, that's another economic powerhouse within the country. So, again, just another way showing you the EU map without Britain. But there are other places in the world, and here we come to the one that took effect in 2020, the United States, Mexico, Canada agreement, formerly known as NAFTA. Replaced NAFTA a while ago. And though NAFTA officially is expired, governments and companies are still adjusting, even now, to the new rules, most notably the new labor provisions, so they're still working on this integration issue among our countries, if you aren't sure where those three countries are, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Also, we have the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP. That's a free trade agreement among the Asian Pacific nations of Australia, Brunei, Cambodia, China, Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, New Zealand, and the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. Those 15 member countries account for about 30% of the world's population. We had been interested in joining in on that, but due to politics, we're not. So there is the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership countries, a third of the population of 30% of the population of the world. Could be a consumer market for you. So the third trend is global competition. Who are we up against? And how are we going to compete in a world market? And one approach to competing, given all the caveats we've talked about, all the Porter's diamond effects, doing our research, knowing what's going on, is through strategic alliances. A strategic alliance is an agreement among two or more independent firms to cooperate for the purpose of achieving common goals. In our Ford example today, we saw Ford is now dealing with a government-owned auto company as a strategic alliance, allowing them to get Ford sold more easily through dealerships in the country. It's working for them. How many of us know Cheerios? How many of us think of Nestle's when we think of Cheerios? Not so much. It's not really done that way here. So Nestle's is head scratching on how to market in Europe, how to market in the UK. And in the UK, Nestle's breakfast cereals are manufactured by Cereal Partners, a joint venture between Nestle's and General Mills. Cereal Partners is one of the UK's leading cereal manufacturers and also makes many of the leading UK retailer brands as well. You might recognize some of these, such as Shredded Wheat, yes, Shreddies, no, and Cheerios. So rather than try to ramp up a retail distribution center and production in the UK, they said, hey, let's partner with somebody who's already well known there, has all that established, boom, we'll become Nestle's Cheerios in the UK. Another approach is to become an international firm. For international firms, we say that marketing is done the same way internationally as it's done domestically. Pretty much we keep everything the same. Belron is a vehicle glass repair and replacement group that operates worldwide across 34 countries. And you would consider them probably an international company because international marketing is done pretty much the same way as they do it domestically. Let's listen to their international jingles. Cardless repair, cardless substitution. Auto glass repair, auto glass replace. Cardless repair, cardless remplace. Cardless repariert, cardless tauscht aus. Cardless replace, και βάζει cardless αντικαρτιστά. So does that little jingle sound at all familiar from the U.S.? So they pretty much translated it into different countries of the world. Safe light repair, safe light replace. And so they're using that same approach, that same strategy worldwide. We would say, hey, pretty much you're doing marketing in other countries the same way you're doing it domestically, so you're an international firm. It can work for some companies, obviously. Multinational firms use a multi-domestic marketing strategy. What they're going to do is vary the marketing mix in each country. Off the top of your head, what are some advantages of that? Say again? We'll reach the consumers in each country better and hence more consumers. What would a problem be in using a multinational approach, do you suppose? What's the issue with that? It's expensive. You're ramping up multiple marketing campaigns, multiple products, multiple model sizes, multiple colors, multiple brand names. You're reaching maybe the consumers a little better, but you got a lot of cost involved in there. Nonetheless, obviously, some companies use a multi-domestic marketing strategy. I might be doing a disservice to Nestle's, but let's for the moment say that they vary their marketing mix out for each country. And so if we look at some of their brand listing, what we're going to find is brands that we know and brands we've just never heard of at all. Well, here's one. So we know Carnation, we know Coffee Mate, we don't know whatever that is. A brand that is different in whatever country that's appropriate for. We know Gerber, we don't know Nature Nest, Cerelac, or Nido. So they are doing quite a mix across the countries that they deal with. Here we see their marketing structure, Nestlé's headquarters in Vevey, Switzerland, which we also used to visit. Product positioning, brand logo, packaging, and pricing done there. But we've got different approaches in the US, in France, in Italy, in Germany. And so we might say that they are a bit of a multinational firm. Then a different approach is what's called a transnational firm. These folks use a global marketing strategy to standardize the marketing mix where there are cultural similarities, and then change the marketing mix when the cultures differ. So we're trying to do a balance here, mix and match. So the goal of transnational firms is to create and maintain a balanced portfolio of global and local brands. And now we begin to get around that cost problem a little bit. Where we can, we standardize. We do things globally the same, so we reduce the costs by getting economies of scale, sharing R&D and technical features and manufacturing across brands where possible. And we grow those global brands where we can. On the other hand, where it's not going to work, because the foreign country we're going into is too different, then we're going to obtain market penetration, your point about more reaching more people, through brand differentiation when necessary. So we're trying to get the best of both worlds in this approach. Henkel is a German company with businesses in 125 countries, employing more than 50,000 people, and marketing more than 10,000 products, including core businesses in laundry and home care, cosmetics and toiletries, and adhesive and technologies. And Henkel, I would say, is a transnational firm. So here we see there are three strategic business units, if you will: laundry and home care, cosmetics and toiletries, and adhesive technologies. And in the US, they operate quite a lot of brands, initially in Scottsdale and then over to Stamford, Connecticut. So we're going to take a quick peek at their laundry and home care products companies. And who do they compete against in the US? Well, global companies like P&G and Lever Brothers, multinational companies like Thinkister, and a transnational company themselves, Henkel. So let's look at the hand dishwashing liquid category, one teeny part of their business. How many of you guys still use soap detergent sometimes to clean up your, squeeze it in, wash your dishes? Yeah, still a thing. All right. That's got a 90% plus penetration in the US. It's a huge market. You would say it's simple, yeah, but it turns out that consumer habits do differ from country to country. And all of these players are battling for market share. How are we going to do our best business in these different countries of the world? We're going to use localization. We're going to standardize this across all countries where we can to get low cost production, low complexity, and roll out our concepts fast. And we're going to use differentiation where we have to be close to the customer, have flexible responses, and to get regional market penetration. So this is localization. The marketing strategy as much as possible is global, but the implementation of the marketing tactics at the in-country needs to be more local depending on the situation. How does this play out in practice? Well, let's go back to our dishwashing liquid example. Before they implemented this, this was their list of dishwashing products. I'm sure it wasn't the whole thing, but it's the example. So they had Pril and Purr and Purr and Pril and Myrrh and Mistol and whatever that says, all in different colors, all with different caps, all in different bottles. And you say, why is that a big deal? Man, if you're producing a kajillion, I don't know how much that is, bottles a year, and you have to do 5 or 7 different types, you're wasting a bunch of money doing that. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go out and I'm going to investigate these markets and I'm going to see, do you really care about the shape of your bottle for your dishwashing liquid? If not, maybe I can just produce one bottle. So you can see what they did after they looked across their markets in the second thing. Look at how much more shared bottle size and shape they had. Notice that the caps for most countries are the same. They just saved themselves a bundle. by going more global. So what did they find out? Well, the brand name itself mattered. They did need to have different brand names in different countries. The subname, dishwashing liquid or whatever they call it, mattered. But the concept, the payoff, the positioning, the communication, all could be the same across all these countries they're marketing in. I do not know why the product texture, how it feels, had to be a little different in some countries, but people prefer different textures in their dishwashing liquid. The bottle shake, the logo, the lettering, the background, the key visuals, all could be the same. The formula, pretty much the same, and then a couple other differences over here. Going global, glocalization, using glocalization meant that they were able to standardize a whole bunch of stuff where they could. Mass economies of scale, differentiate only where they had to. So it worked pretty well for them. We return to global marketing and GM to think about how they're doing. As I said earlier, China is important to GM's global strategy. In 2010, GM sold more trucks and cars in China than in the US. It's continued through last year. In November 2022, GM said it would roll out more than 15 new EVs in China and build EV production capacity to more than 1 million units by 2025. In addition to rolling out new electric powertrains in North America and China, GM has already announced plans to introduce EVs based on the Ultium battery technology and the Ultium drive motors in markets such as South Korea, the Middle East, and South America. These additional markets will increase the company's global volume and allow it to compete against global electronic vehicle leaders, but with greater scale. We're going to take a single platform and arrange on that single platform models for all these different countries. Globalization where we can, localization where we have to. So if any of this makes sense, now you get a head scratch on, well, what about this research you talked about? What do I have to know so I succeed before I go global? Well, obviously, one thing you have to do is understand cultural diversity. It's an obvious statement to make, and yet businesses, individual managers, over and over again act like that other place is the same as this place. Those consumers are the same as my consumers. Really? Really? Probably not. Did you look into that at all? What about the importance of family, if that's your target market? What's the size of the family? Realizing it was a mistake after decades, but until a few years ago, what was the family size in China?
One child.
Two parents, one child, you're done. Actually created a bit of a population deficit for them. They're trying to reverse that right now. And they're rewarding people for having more than one child. In the US, obviously, we have 2.1 births per family, and their family size is a lot bigger. What's the style of the family? We talked about consumer decision-making as a family. How's that work? What are the relationships? Is it matriarchal, patriarchal? How important are the kids in this country? Some places, kids still shut up, seen and not heard. What about their tastes and their customs and their behaviors? How will those vary? When Kentucky Fried Chicken, who was an early mover into the international trade, first goes to Japan, their first store was almost identical to their US stores. Where do I get to here? I say I'm going to get to Gerber. Doesn't matter. Their first store is almost the same as U.S. stores as they moved to Japan. One problem is Japan is an island country. You can't have a big store with a big parking lot near Tokyo. It'd be like doing it in Manhattan. You ever see a big freestanding store in Manhattan? It's stupid. Took them a while to learn that wasn't going to work. But then they did some other things. For example, they found that their coleslaw was too sweet for the Japanese consumer. That's a no-brainer. They fixed that pretty quickly. There was an issue of cooking fish and cooking chicken. I think they were doing both at the same store. The Chinese consumer was concerned about would the chicken have a fishy taste. They had to work on those sorts of details. What are the behaviors, the tastes, the customs of the country you're going to? Have you ever heard of this book, Kiss, Bow, or Shake Hands? When you meet somebody in a foreign country, what do? French, you kiss on each cheek. Japan, you bow. U.S., you shake hands. For a while, there's a funny commercial where U.S. businessmen are meeting Japanese businessmen, and they go back and forth in terms of who's bowing and who's shaking hands. They couldn't figure out what to do. Different countries interact in different ways. This was my example that I used earlier about Gerber making a mistake, going to Africa without understanding that a lot of that population who had money, who shopped in stores, read that to be ground up baby. What's the equivalent issue in you take your product to market? Obviously, language is a big deal. A long time ago, when Pepsi took its theme to Japan, they had a thing, the Pepsi generation, come alive with Pepsi, translated as bring your ancestors out of their grave with Pepsi. Did not think that went all the way through. We've heard before whether or not it's really true, an old car model of Ford's Nova was moved over to Spanish-speaking countries, and if you say it just right, Nova in Spanish means doesn't go. Not a great name for a car. Nobody thought that went through all the way. So what about the language issues as you go internationally? So these things are caused by a series of impediments. One of them is what's called the self-reference criteria. This is human nature, an unconscious reference to your own values, your own experiences, your own knowledge, as a basis for making certain decisions, including, of course, marketing decisions. You don't even think about it. Well, of course, we do it this way here, we'll do it there, of course. No. This approach to international business can result in a failure to develop an open attitude and a cultural sensitivity, which would enable managers to look carefully at the foreign market and to understand the customer's needs in that country and not simply transfer the needs of the domestic market over there. This is not the most egregious problem when we think about foreign markets. A little bit worse would be ethnocentrism. It's not just thinking that, well, whatever you do there works, whatever we do here works there. Ethnocentrism is the belief that your culture is better than everybody else's culture. So you aren't just going to do the same. You're going to teach those people how it should be done. They've been doing things a long time without you there. They probably don't need you to go in and tell them how to live their lives. So we have to be careful that we train managers not to be ethnocentric. Walmart attempted to implement its successful strategies in Japan, including its everyday low prices campaign. Seems like that should work, right? Everyday low prices? No, it doesn't. Doesn't have the same value in Japan as it does in the US, because Japanese customers associate low prices with cheap quality, making them very wary about shopping there. Their local operations are struggling, they're closing stores. And I'm gonna use this as a last example because we're almost out of time. Nike released a set of women's sports gear inspired by traditional tattoos from the Southwest Pacific, but the international sports brand made a cultural faux pas and ended up pulling the product. The women's leggings created the appearance that the world had traditional Samoan tattoo. The pace, it's not, I still have 1 minute, let me finish my thing, which is reserved for men. They did not take their time to consult with those in the know. A blogger said their use of tattoo was an ugly exploit of culture. Another said to the outside world, just such a design, but to my Polynesian people, it's sacred. Go off and do your sacred business. This is the end of material for mini test 6. See you next time.